Welcome to Witness, a ministry of Covenant Presbyterian Church in Jackson, Mississippi. Join us in person for worship each Sunday at 9:30 and 11 a.m. For more information about Covenant, including discipleship and mission opportunities, visit us at www.covenantpresjackson.org.
The sixth commandment is the first of three commandments in a row, which are just two words each in the Hebrew, a form of the word no and a verb, forbidding murder, adultery, and theft. Laws which are found in every civilized society. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that these laws are necessary for a society to be civil. Now, I'm not going to spend much time making an argument for something which everyone, atheist, Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, and Christian alike, already holds to be true. I'm going to focus on some of the ways this commandment has been misunderstood and misapplied, starting with what the law actually forbids and then what it requires. If you grew up with the King James Version of the Bible or the American Standard Version or even the Revised Standard Version, then you know this verse as thou shalt not kill. And that word kill has led to misunderstandings because it's not very specific. We're not allowed to kill what? People? Animals? Plants? Nothing? Ever? For any reason? That's what a strictly literal interpretation of this verse would suggest, and some Christians have believed that. But a careful study of the context, looking at how the law is applied throughout Scripture, reveals that the sin forbidden is much narrower than the word kill suggests. What is actually forbidden is the unjust killing of a person. So there are two qualifications I added to make the meaning clear, that the killing is unjust and that it's of a human being. Other living things are permissible to be killed by humans. We see this in the first several chapters of the first book of the Bible. In the garden, Adam and Eve were sustained by the fruit of the trees, and the prized fruit among the trees came from the tree of life. But Satan convinced them to eat from the forbidden fruit. Once they did, among other things, the ground was cursed, and they were told that from then on, they would eat the plants of the field. So the Lord gave them permission to eat more than just the fruit, but the plants themselves, which are living things. Then, after God pronounced his judgment in the garden, he gave Adam and Eve clothing made of animal skin, which implies that the Lord himself killed an animal to clothe them. In the very next chapter, we see that God was not grieved, but pleased by the animal sacrifice of Abel. And then Noah, after the flood, was explicitly told that he and his family could eat meat. So God has given us permission to kill animals and plants for food or to offer as a sacrifice. And we do not have this permission for people. In fact, God has explicitly forbidden the killing of people for food or to offer as a sacrifice. So this prohibition against killing must be restricted to people. Now, the second qualification is the word unjust. And we have a word in the English language that specifically refers to the unjust killing of a person, murder, which is why the ESV and many other modern translations have rendered the command, you shall not murder. This qualification is made because killing a person can be justified, but the murder of a person cannot. The Bible justifies killing in the cases of capital punishment, self-defense, and just wars. Now, last week, our passage from the book of Deuteronomy allowed for capital punishment to be used in extreme cases of rebellious children. And capital punishment is also warranted for other crimes, murder, adultery, incest, sodomy, rape, and human sacrifice. In some situations, a person convicted of a capital crime could pay a ransom to make restitution. But this practice was strictly forbidden if their sin was murder. Numbers chapter 35, verse 31 says, "Moreover, you shall accept no ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall be put to death." And hundreds of years before God gave the law to Moses, the Lord said to Noah, "And for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. From every beast, I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image." So God is clear that the punishment for murder is death, because he requires a reckoning for the life of man. Thus, the purpose of capital punishment is not deterrence, though hopefully it has that impact, but rather its purpose is retribution. And it is an awful punishment for an awful crime. But we must keep in mind that the death penalty is not the final judgment a person receives, nor is it the worst thing that can happen to somebody. Eternal separation from God is. Unfortunately, God gets the final say in the end. Now, the thief on the cross, rightfully dying for his sin next to Jesus, was forgiven when he placed his trust in Jesus. And he wasn't miraculously removed from the cross. Something better happened. He was told the good news of the gospel, that he would be with Jesus in paradise that day. And death is not the end. Killing a criminal convicted of a capital offense is justified and not a violation of this commandment, because God himself prescribes death for certain crimes. And in fact, refusing to kill someone convicted of a capital offense would make you guilty for any additional deaths caused by not carrying out justice. The Puritan Thomas Watson made the point this way: a private person sins if he draws the sword. A public person sins if he puts up the sword. A magistrate ought not to let the sword of justice rust in the scabbard. As he should not let the sword be too sharp by severity, so neither should the edge of it be blunted by too much leniency. A capital punishment is a just means of killing a person, so it does not violate this commandment. Now, I also mentioned that war can be justified. A war is a terrible thing that should be avoided at all costs. But there are times in the Bible, such as in the book of Joshua, where the Lord called his people to go to war as a means of him exercising capital punishment on entire nations that stood in rebellion to God with sinful practices such as child sacrifice. Now, God disciplined Israel as well through war and exile to the Assyrians and Babylonians. This was his means of exercising divine judgment on a nation's sin, and so it was just. Now, God has given the power of the sword to the legitimate governing authorities he has appointed. This enables some amount of order to be achieved, because as awful as it is, war is sometimes necessary to bring about justice in a fallen world. A war should never be entered into flippantly, because both sides will be harmed. We must carefully consider whose sin is leading to this conflict and our own motives for escalating it. Now, sometimes it might be easy to justify, such as when Abraham put together a military force to rescue Lot, or when the Jewish people, during the time of Esther, were permitted to defend themselves against those who sought their death. But other times, both parties might be equally at fault. Now, if war cannot be avoided, it should be entered with the goal of bringing about peace. Christians may participate in wars that are justified, wars that have become necessary for the preservation of life. But making that judgment call requires great wisdom and good leaders. No human government will make the right call every time. So we should promote laws that accommodate conscientious objections so that we're never forced to support a war that we view as unjust. These are heavy topics. And now that I've narrowed the scope of the commandment to the unjust killing of a person, let's examine how Jesus broadened the scope during his Sermon on the Mount. Jesus introduced the sixth commandment saying, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder,' and whoever murders will be liable to judgment." And the judgment they would be liable to, as I said, is capital punishment, the death penalty. But then Jesus broadens the scope of the law because before the sin of murder ever occurs, other sins have been committed that led up to it. Sins that begin in the heart, anger and envy. Now, anger isn't always bad. It's an emotional response to something that isn't sitting right with you. It's a warning. And when you feel angry, you ought to pause and consider why. Now, the Lord asked Jonah, "Do you do well to be angry?" And Jonah was not justified in his anger. And so the Lord encouraged him to try and see things from his perspective. But sometimes we are right to be angry. And Paul wrote to the Ephesians, "Be angry and do not sin." And we should be angered by things that are unjust. But in our anger, it isn't right for us to sin. Now, Jesus said, "Everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, 'You fool,' will be liable to the hell of fire." Now, this verse has a similar problem as the translation, "Thou shalt not kill." It's unqualified. And the problem is resolved with a particular manuscript tradition, which adds the phrase, "without cause," so that Jesus is saying that everyone who is angry with his brother without cause will be liable to judgment. The King James Version includes this phrase, but the ESV doesn't, because though it has a strong tradition, it's a late addition to the original text. However, it was probably added to the text to clarify the intent of Jesus, because even Jesus expressed anger and even called the Pharisees fools in the same gospel account during the cleansing of the temple. But he did not sin because he was justified in his anger. They were corrupting the temple, and Jesus had proper authority over the temple given to him by God. Justified anger is a good thing because it leads to justice. Unjustified anger, on the other hand, takes us down a dark path of breaking the sixth commandment in a variety of ways. We might break it physically, not just by committing murder, but also by hitting, scratching, biting, or even spitting on someone. Or we might break it with our tongue, in their face, by cursing them, or behind their back, by slandering their name. Now, the words we say matter. The old childish saying, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me," is false. The words can't be unsaid, and their wounds cannot be healed by a physician. And even after the words have been long forgotten, they never truly go away. They can resurface in the mind without warning and cause the same wound again. The people have done irreparable damage to the reputation of others with their words. The advent of social media has enabled people to broadcast their words much farther than was ever previously possible. Well, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Things that are good, beautiful, and true can be shared. But gossip and hatred can spread like wildfire online. And once it's been put out there, there's no taking it back. There's an old Jewish story that illustrates this well. It tells of a nice young man with a love for telling stories. He was good at embellishing them just enough to make them a little funnier and juicier. One day he heard something weird but true about another businessman in town. And of course, he felt compelled to share what he knew with his colleagues, who told it to their friends, who told it to the people they knew, who told it to their wives, who spoke with their friends and their neighbors. It went around town, till the unhappy businessman, who was the main character in the story, heard it. And he ran to the rabbi of the town and wailed and complained that he was ruined. Nobody would like to deal with him after this. His good name and reputation were gone with the wind. Well, the rabbi knew the people in the town well, so he suspected the nice young man who loved telling stories may have been the one who started it. And so he summoned him. The young man felt terrible. He honestly hadn't considered it such a big deal to tell the story because it was mostly true. Well, true or not, it makes no difference, said the rabbi. It's slander, and it's like murder. You kill a person's reputation. And he said a lot more than that, but you get the point. The young man who started the rumor now felt really bad and sorry. What can I do to make it undone? He sobbed. I'll do anything you say. The rabbi looked at him. Do you have any feather pillows in your house? Rabbi, I'm not poor. I have a whole bunch of them. But what do you want me to do, sell them? No, just bring me one. Well, the man was mystified. But he returned a bit later to the rabbi's study with a nice fluffy pillow under his arm. And the rabbi opened the window and handed him a knife. Cut it open. But rabbi, here in your study, it will make a mess. Do as I say. And the man cut the pillow. And a cloud of feathers came out. They landed on the chairs and on the bookcase, on the clock, on the cat, which jumped after them. They floated over the table and into the teacups, on the rabbi and on the man with the knife. And a lot of them flew out of the window in a big, swirling, whirling trail. The rabbi waited 10 minutes. Then he ordered the man, "Now bring me back all the feathers and put them back in your pillow. All of them, mind you. Not one may be missed." And the man stared at the rabbi in disbelief. "That is impossible, rabbi. The ones here in the room I might get, most of them, but the ones that flew out of the window are gone." "Yes," said the rabbi and nodded gravely. "That is how it is. Once a rumor or a gossipy story or a secret leaves your mouth, you do not know where it ends up. It flies on the wings of the wind, and you can never get it back." Words are powerful. We must use them to build others up, not tear them down, because the damage they cause is often worse than we intend. Now, up to this point, we have focused on what the sixth commandment forbids, the unjust killing of another person, as well as unjust anger and hateful words. Well, let us now turn our attention to what the sixth command requires. We are to preserve our own life and the life of others. This applies to attitudes of the heart as well as physical life. In our passage from Matthew, Jesus made two brief comments that illustrate the importance of being reconciled with those who have wronged us or who we have wronged. And they both point to the urgency we should have to fix the situation. Reconciliation takes precedence even over worship. He said to leave your gift at the altar, go and be reconciled, and then come back. Now, the point isn't that we should skip Sunday morning worship until we have sought reconciliation. Rather, we should think, Sunday's coming. I need to try to make this situation right. And Paul echoes this in Ephesians, writing, "Don't let the sun go down on your anger." Now, please understand that you are only responsible for your end. You can admit your fault and ask for forgiveness, but you cannot make someone forgive you, nor can you make them accept your sincere apology. That's something for them to work out in their hearts. If you've made earnest efforts to be reconciled, then you are upholding the duty of this command. But if you don't seek reconciliation, the problem won't go away on its own. It festers. It is a sin that leads to death. Now, the sixth commandment also requires us to preserve the physical life of ourselves and others. This includes eating and drinking in moderation, exercising, getting adequate sleep, taking our mental health seriously, and doing things to support the physical well-being of others. The scope of this commandment is far-reaching, and we couldn't possibly cover everything that falls under it. Suicide, abortion, end-of-life care, adoption, foster care, welfare. But we should be reminded to carefully apply biblical ethics to all of life in such a way that promotes life. And that is how we are to love our neighbor and uphold God's law. And if I have accomplished my goal of broadening your understanding of the sixth commandment, then you must know that you have broken it and are liable to judgment. We all have. But there is one person who has not broken it, though he was reviled for it. Jesus was murdered by the thoughts and words of those who stood against him 2,000 years ago and by those who hate and mock him today. People have never gotten over him. His words will not go away. Jesus was murdered by Judas, who betrayed him. And he was murdered by the religious leaders and the high priest, who subjected him to a mock trial. He was murdered by Pontius Pilate. Though Pilate tried to wash his hands of his guilt, his gesture was meaningless because he knew that Jesus was innocent, but approved his death anyway to please the crowd. Jesus was also murdered by the Roman soldiers that carried out the decree. And even you and I are responsible for his murder, because it was our sin that sent him there. Jesus fulfilled the duty required in the sixth commandment by giving himself up to death on a cross as the ultimate act of reconciliation and preservation of life. His blood was shed as a reckoning for the lifeblood of all who have been murdered in thought, word, and deed. And along the way, Jesus prayed that the Lord would forgive those who hated him out of ignorance, saying, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." He was always an agent of reconciliation, and he did not let the sun go down on him before he forgave those who hated him. He did this before offering his gift on the altar of altars, the cross. The penalty for breaking the sixth commandment is capital punishment, and that is what Jesus received for you, so that you can be reconciled to God once and for all time. So let us live as those who have been reconciled, free from guilt and shame, and may we serve as agents of reconciliation in the world, upholding the sanctity of life at every opportunity. And that's not an easy task, but we aren't on our own. It's a task for the church, and Christ will lead us. Amen.
Thank you for tuning in to Witness, a ministry of Covenant Presbyterian Church in Jackson, Mississippi.